They're altitude limited, Joshua observed. The insects.
Yeah, most of the larger species, not all. Enough to make the summit survivable.
Survivable by who?
By us, Joshua. Well, specifically, by you.
We're stopping here?
Yeah, not long. Maybe overnight.
Why?
We've an appointment to keep up here. This is why you wanted to start us off in the Cascades. I'll drop an anchor, deploy the ladder. The grassy stretch by that stream down there looks a good place to camp. Take the tape, the cassette, you know.
Somewhat reluctantly, Joshua began to pull his kit together. A sleeping bag, food packets, fire-making gear, bug repellent spray. I'm going down alone, am I? Bill sounded embarrassed.
Look, Joshua, I don't want to sound like a fanboy here. Your journey's famous, and of course I know the inside story. The idea of you going down into all them unknown worlds all alone, while Lobsang stayed tucked up in the airship. Comedy gold.
Well, that's a consolation for all the scars.
But the strategy actually makes sense. You go down, do the exploring thing, make contact.
And Joshua wondered, contact with what?
Meanwhile, I'll stay aloft, ready to help out when it all goes tits up.
When?
If, mate, if. Slip of the tongue.
Not for the first time in the course of his adventures in the Long Earth, and against his own better judgment, Joshua went with the flow. Bill insisted that he carry a two-way radio and a small shoulder unit with TV and sensor links. Joshua agreed, despite unpleasant memories of Lobsang's shoulder-riding parrots, and for his part, packed a handgun. The climb down into the undergrowth was easy. Immediately he was on the ground, the ship rose, taking the ladder with it. Alone, Joshua turned around slowly. In this open space that the stream had carved between the trees, it was pleasant enough. The air smelled of damp wood and the leaf mould of millennia, and he heard the remote buzz of the lapping ocean of insect swarms below this summit. Over his head, squadrons of some insectile equivalent of bats hurtled after things like flies. He had nothing much to do but wait. He began to make his camp, spreading out his blanket roll and sleeping bag. He thought about a fire, but the air was warm and moist enough without it. With his travel rations, he didn't need to cook. He began to relax. It was almost like he was on sabbatical. He toyed with the idea of doing some fishing just for fun, if the streams on this summit supported any fish. The radio clicked into life.
Josh, can you hear me, mate?
No.
Ha ha. How you doing down there?
Making a restaurant reservation.
Funny you should say that. If it does all go tits up and you need supplies quickly, there's a cache, only a mile or so downstream.
A cache? Of what?
Survival stuff. A little shelter, a bit of food, knives, tools, spare laces for your boots, left by combers, four combers.
Joshua sat on his sleeping bag. Bill, what is this place? Why did we stop here? I mean, in a joker. Who the hell stops in jokers?
Combers do. That's the point, really. You want to know the story of this world? How Earth West 110,719 got its locusts? Our best guess is that pterosaurs never evolved on this world.
Pterosaurs?
And other flying dinosaurs. Back on the datum, before the pterosaurs, big insects ruled the skies. Got as big as they could, in fact, exploiting the high oxygenation of the air. Then, when the pterosaurs came along, the big insects got hunted down, and only the little ones survived, and they never got so big again. After that, the skies belonged to the pterosaurs, and later the birds. Here, no pterosaurs for whatever reason. And later, the birds didn't have a chance to grow large either. So, here it's not swallows chasing flies. Here, huge rapacious dragonflies hunt down birds the size of big moths.
Not a world for humans, then.
No chance.
But the combers come here.
Of course.
And to survivable refuges in other jokers.
Joshua, A joker is a whole world, and it isn't going to be the same all over. There are always going to be safe places, refuges like this. You get to know them.
How?
Through other comas. There's a whole subculture that people like you and even Lobsang know nothing about, and we like it that way. You think the story of the Long Earth is about colonies like Hell Knows Where, or Helen's Reboot, or cities like Valhalla, and wars of independence and whatnot. All the mad old stuff from Dayton history, projected into the new worlds. Well, that isn't the story, Joshua. It's about a new way of living, or maybe a very old one. The comas haven't colonized the Long Earth, Joshua. Nor have they adapted it to suit themselves. They just live in it, as it is.
This lecture surprised Joshua, who had grown up with Bill, and now shared a town with him, and thought he knew him.
How do you know?
Oh, you know, you have your sabbaticals. I take off for a bit of an old stroll myself from time to time. I always come back, too fond of my home comforts, that's my problem, and of the odd drink. But it's always a grand vacation. Anyhow, I know how these fellas think.
Joshua thought that over.
And we need coma thinking now to find the trolls, right?
Because trolls live in the Long Earth too, and they know the secret places, the places to hide out, like comas are learning.
It's getting dark, I noticed.
Joshua, you're happy down there for the night?
There are various exotic horrors lurking, needless to say.
But you've got infrared sensors, sonar motion sensors. You'll spot any moving bodies, hot-blooded or cold-blooded, right?
Wake me if you need to.
No worries. Sleep tight, buddy.
And you.
He woke up in a grey, moist dawn. Even before he opened his eyes, he was aware of an uneasy prickling at the back of the neck, the product of a million years of animal sensitivity trying to kick its way past the doorkeeper of the cerebrum. He was being watched. And he heard words.
Pathless one.
Still in his sleeping bag, he sat up. The elf was leaning against a tree trunk a few yards away, blending into the shadows so perfectly that Joshua might never have noticed it if it hadn't turned its head and grinned. Low dawn sunlight fell on two rows of perfectly triangular teeth. Then the elf stepped out into the open light, reaching the sleeping bag in a couple of strides. It was no more than 4 feet tall, and was squat and strong, with a face that owed something to a solemn baboon, and a punk rock hairstyle that owed everything to a cockatoo. It wore a sort of leather loincloth, and carried a leather pouch at its waist. It was bootless, showing feet that were quite human, except for the talon-like toenails. Joshua looked for other weapons and couldn't see any. He was oddly reminded of a mole, its paws equipped for digging. This was like nothing so much as an overgrown, vaguely human-shaped, upright, clothes-wearing mole. An upright mole wearing sunglasses. The lenses were cracked and scarred, and the creature's ears, folded flat against its blunt skull, didn't look up to the job of support, so the shades were fixed in place with a band of grubby elastic. The elf grinned again. Joshua could smell its breath from here. His gun was inside the sleeping bag. Joshua got a distinct impression that attempting to reach it would be the single most stupid thing he could possibly do. At such times, thought Joshua, there had to be a more useful opening than "A star shines on the hour of our meeting." But that was what crackled out of the radio on the ground by the sleeping bag. Bill was evidently watching. The elf grinned again and said,
"I wish you a good death."
English. It spoke English. It was an elf, obviously, a member of one of the many slim, gracile species of humanoids that had come to be known as elves across the Long Earth. But though he'd never seen one before, Joshua immediately knew what subspecies this must be.
"He's a kobold."
"Evidently," murmured Bill from the radio. "Some folks call them ringtails, or urban foxes according to the feckin' English.
I thought they were a coma legend.
Don't tell him that. He might get the hump.
I have him on infrared, said Bill.
I see his weaponry. He won't harm you.
Well, probably not.
Tell me how you'd describe him.
Can you imagine Gandhi meets Peter Pan?
No.
The kobold grinned, showing those sharp teeth.
Not worry, little man. I protect. Be safe. Be friend.
Great. My name's Joshua. He nodded gravely.
No, Lobsang send you.
Lobsang? You know about Lobsang? Why aren't I surprised? Bill said,
You're all over the kobold grapevine, Joshua. Especially since I started putting out feelers about Sally on your behalf.
You got stone that sings?
The stone that sings?
Yeah. Stone that eats soul of man sings. The holy music. Men that sing after death.
The kobold paused, moving his lips as he thought hard, and added,
Like Buddy Holly.
Say yes, said Bill.
Yes.
Flip, Joshua. Do I have to spell it out to ye? Give him the cassette.
Oh, the stone that sings. I get it.
Joshua reached for his jacket, which he had been using as a pillow, found the battered old cassette tape in the pocket, and handed it over. The kobold reached across and took it like a devout worshipper handling a relic. He sniffed at it, held it to his ear, and shook it gently.
Bill was here before. We talk. He give me music. He give coffee. He give machine that drinks sunlight and plays holy music.
You mean a cassette machine?
The kobold turned the tape over in his long fingers.
Kinks?
It's the album you wanted, Bill said from the radio. The Kinks are the Village Green Preservation Society.
Good.
The kobold dug a battered old tape drive Walkman from the pouch at his waist, held up a glittering solar cell surface to face the sunlight, pulled ancient-looking headphones around his neck, and pushed the tape into a slot.
Extras?
You've got the 12-track mono version released in Europe, and then the 15-track UK edition in stereo and mono. And some rarities. An alternate mix of Animal Farm. An unreleased track called Mick Avery's Underpants.
But the kobold was no longer listening. He backed up against a tree, the worn foam of the headphones pressed against his ears. Bill said softly,
That's it. He's out of it for a couple of hours while he checks that out. Joshua, if you need breakfast, now's a good time.
The Kinks, Bill?
A great 1960s band from the UK who made it big in the US with I Don't Care.
No disrespect to the Kinks. What's with the tape?
Trade goods, Joshua. Kobolds like human culture. Some of them are big on music. This one was hooked when he first heard Waterloo Sunset. He's a kind of snitch, an informant. I get him the music he wants. He gives me information.
Yeah, but who uses a cassette machine?
Well, he's older than he looks, Joshua. He's been doing trades like this for years. And he's a humanoid with an evolutionary path that split off from mankind's millions of years ago.
He's not likely to be a technology early adopter, is he?
Joshua pushed his way out of his sleeping bag.
I need a coffee.
Chapter 44 The first steppers, exploring the long earth, had found no trace of modern man away from the datum. Oh, they had found a few stone tools. They had found fossil hearths in the depths of caves. They'd even found a few bones, but no great leap forward, no cave paintings, no flower-adorned burials, no cities, no high technology, well, none that was human. The spark of higher intellect must have been lit behind beetling pre-human brows on a million worlds, just as on Datum Earth, but it hadn't caught anywhere other than on the Datum.
Whatever the reason, the alternate universes into which Earth's pioneers poured out were mostly dark, quiet worlds. Worlds of trees, many of them. Earths like great tumbled forests. The datum itself was just a clearing in the trees, a spark of civilization, one circle of firelight, beyond which the shadows spread to infinity. There were humanoids out there, descendants of lost cousins of humanity, but people knew they would never encounter a humanoid that was anything like as smart as they were. Never a humanoid that could speak English, for example. The only thing wrong with this generally accepted picture was that it was totally incorrect. Professor Wotan Oom of Oxford University, author of the best-selling if controversial book Moonwatcher's Cousins, The Humanoid Radiation Across the Long Earth, gave the context for the species, known as kobolds, in an interview for the BBC. "Of course, such is the patchiness of our exploration of the Long Earth so far, that we can come to only tentative conclusions. The evidence for kobolds themselves is little more than legend and anecdote. Nevertheless, DNA analysis of samples returned by early expeditions, including a tooth found embedded in the boot of Joshua Valiente, confirms that the humanoids of Long Earth diverged from Datum Earth stock several million years ago, probably at the time of the rise of Homo habilis, the first tool-making hominid. This supports my own hypothesis that it was the increased cognitive skills of H. habilis that enabled some members of that species to step sideways into the other Earths. The ability to imagine the tool in the stone, perhaps, is related to the ability to imagine another world entirely, and then to reach out for it. After this divergence, the departure of the steppers, with the datum inhabited by the descendants of the residuum who could not step, humanoids radiated into the Long Earth, evolving in a variety of niches, and across 4 million years, natural selection has proved remarkably inventive. One fundamental boundary among the humanoid species is whether they retained their ability to step or not. Some did, as we know, like the form known as the trolls. Others did not. Having found an earth of suitable habitability, these groups settled down, lost their ability to step. In some cases also lost the intelligence that underpinned that stepping ability, and began to populate their single earth. This should not surprise us. The juvenile sea squirt is mobile, with a central nervous system and a brain. Once it has found a suitable rock, it settles down, opens its mouth to begin a life of sedentary feeding, absorbs its brain, and turns on the TV. Similarly, birds, having colonized an island free of predators, will lose their ability to fly. Flight, like intelligence, is energetically expensive and may be selected out if not used, if no longer necessary for survival. Similarly, presumably, with stepping. A second evolutionary boundary among the nomadic species is whether they have had extended contact with humanity on Datum Earth or not. If they have not had contact, they may have evolved into forms quite unfamiliar from experience on the datum, such as the trolls. If they have had contact with mankind, you might think we would know about it. Well, in a sense, we do. It's remarkable how much human folklore can be explained away if you postulate humanoid races that can move stepwise at will. As for the human contact humanoids themselves, their subsequent evolution must have been affected. They may grow to look like us for cover. They may look threatening or cute to disarm us. Or, most interestingly, they may have evolved speech mechanisms like ours in order to deal with us in some way. Even intelligence might have been promoted in competition with us. And so we come to the kobolds. These creatures may indeed be the kobolds of myth, the source of German legends of mind spirits, which are also known as types of gnome or dwarf or Bergmanline, little mountain men. They would infest metal mines and would be heard rather than seen. They could be helpful. Their knocking could guide human miners to rich ore seams, or warn them of danger. In Cornwall, England, they became known as Tommy Knockers.
And they would sometimes steal human artifacts, gewgaws like mirrors, combs. They were evidently fascinated by human material culture, though they could not emulate it.
It has to be said that the observed kobolds' robust anatomy, their aversion to bright light, their hands and feet evidently adapted for digging into the earth, are all features consistent with an underground origin. Perhaps they evolved in the subterranean datum, or at least adapted to it, their ancestors having stepped away and returned. And perhaps in recent centuries, the rising human population finally drove them away, leaving them separated from humanity, until our own stepping diffusion began. The word kobold, incidentally, is the source of the name kobold. Oddly enough, though these creatures are in many ways the most human-like of the humanoid species, and in some ways the most cognitively advanced, they are among the most secretive. Perhaps that's because of the derogatory names humans tend to give them, or perhaps it's just because they know humans. It may be surprising to a layman that there are any sedentary long-earth humanoids who have been shaped over evolutionary timescales by contact with humans. This can only come about, of course, if that species returned to datum Earth and then lost its stepping ability. Well, there is one datum species that may fit this category, though the genetic evidence is controversial. The bonobo chimps. In retrospect, who could ever have imagined that these gentle creatures belong on the same planet as the likes of us? Not to mention their cousins, the common chimps, who are almost as unpleasant as we are. No wonder the bonobos' ancestors got out of here as soon as they could steal a car. And bad luck for the present-day bonobos that their more recent ancestors came wandering back. Is that enough, Jocasta? Then perhaps you could tell the long-haired kobold look-alike in the production booth that eating a burger all the way through my interview was even more off-putting than you might expect.
Chapter 45.
You have more kinks?
Some, whispered Bill through the radio.
Give.
No. What is your name? Joshua asked at last. The kobold grinned. At least his teeth grinned.
My name to men is Finn McCool.
I taught her that, Bill said. Seemed to fit.
I give no name for men. Not my name.
Finn McCool will do, Joshua said.
People of the pathless world, stranger than Trollen,
Finn McCool said, studying Joshua and his bits of kit.
How live? No weapon?
Oh, I have a weapon.
But one only. You are pathless. We are many.
Many? Where? Where are the rest of you? The kobold held out his hand.
You give this the way, as all know. You give, I talk.
Ignore him, Bill said. We've given already. He's just trying to drive a hard bargain. Joshua studied the kobold. You trade, right? You trade with other humans.
Other humans, and with other not human, not kobolds.
With other types of humanoid, other races.
And they trade with others, others from far worlds.
How far?
Worlds where there is no moon, sun, different color.
Horseshit, said Bill. No such worlds. He's just trying to wheedle more out of you, Joshua. Aren't you Finn McCool? You can't shit a shitter, you little shit. Listen, Joshua. You have to understand what we're dealing with here. These are slippery little buggers. They get around quick. They seem to be able to use soft places. They talk all the time. And they trade with us and each other. But they're not human. They don't do business the way we do, grubbing for wealth, making as much profit as we can. They're more like
collectors?
Something like that, yeah. Like nerds who collect comic books, or like magpies, fascinated by human stuff, shiny gewgaws that they can steal and stare at, but they never understand. There's no logic to it, Joshua. It's just about the stuff they want, that's all. Once you understand that, they're not hard to handle. Big, feckin' ugly magpies with trousers on. That's you, Finn McCool. The kobold just grinned.
Well, I guess you know why we're here, Finn McCool, Joshua said. What we want. Where are the trolls?
You give!
Cough up, you little gobshite, Bill snapped. Finn McCool hissed and said grudgingly,
Trollin' in here, but not here.
Joshua sighed. Textbook enigmatic. Anytime you want to jump in, Bill.
Finn McCool, are you saying the trolls are hiding out in a joker?
Not here.
A joker, but not this joker, as I guessed. But which one?
Finn McCool seemed to Joshua to have no intention of answering.
That's it? Joshua said. That's all we get out of you in return for that magnificent, old tape?
Suddenly McCool stood straight. He sniffed the air with his flat, chimp-like muzzle, and laughed.
Joshua, Bill said urgently, I detect 9, correction 10, no, 11 hotspots converging on you. I now have visual confirmation.
Joshua spun around. A morning mist swirled now between the trees, and the stream was lost to view. Anything could be out there. Water dripped off the leaves of the trees.
What do you mean, What do they look like?
Well, purposeful.
There was a flash of teeth. Finn McCool faded for an instant and was gone. Joshua could have been wrong, but it seemed that McCool's grin was the last bit of him to go. And out of the mists. The rising sun sent spears of reddish light across the grassland, and the altitude of this summit lent a faint chill to the breeze. A few shreds of mist stirred down among the trees that marked the stream, and there were shapes among the trees. They began as mere suggestions of motion in the mist, and then solidified. The general effect was of a wheel slowing from turbine speeds to stillness. When they were still, they were not much taller than a man, but the beanpole thinness gave an exaggerated impression of height. Their skin was greyish, and they wore their ash-blonde hair afro-style. They could have passed muster in some of the badly lit discos Joshua had, if rarely, attended in his youth back in Madison, except for the ears, which were large and pointed, and constantly flicking back and forth as though seeking the faintest sounds, and except for the eyes that glowed a very faint green. They carried long, thin, double-bladed weapons of wood, swords, for want of a better word. They weren't yelling or waving their weapons. They just looked quietly determined. Any child could have put a name to them. Elves. Not relatively friendly, music-loving conversationalists like Finn McCool, the elves of nightmare. And they were closing on Joshua from every direction. Joshua had nowhere to run. He had encountered various species of elves before. He knew that stepping wouldn't help, not when faced with an enemy that was a better stepper than he was. His gun was somewhere in the scuffed-up sleeping bag. Only the radio was in reach, a plastic block the size of his fist. Not much of a weapon. The first elf to reach him brought back its sword for a killing arc and hesitated, as if relishing the moment. Joshua, frozen to the spot, stared back. Close to, the creature looked like something out of a book on prehistory, though a Neanderthal would have considered it ugly. Its face was a network of wrinkles. It wore a short fur tunic, some sort of knapsack, and an expression of calculation. Maybe it was hesitating as it tried to work out which way he was going to step, so it could follow him and kill him anyway. All this in a heartbeat. Then Joshua's reflexes took over. He ducked, grabbed the radio, and brought it around in a rapid swing that was interrupted by the elf's jaw. Bits of glass and plastic erupted in a shower of golden sparks. As the elf staggered back, Joshua's leg came up for the classic strike favored by women's self-defense teachers everywhere, and a high-pitched squeal of agony added to mankind's tiny stock of anatomical knowledge of long-earth humanoids. And suddenly there was action all around Joshua. McCool was back. He had brought more kobolds, and they were already fighting. The cavalry, Joshua thought with a rush of gratitude. But this was a cavalry that stepped, like its opponents. Suddenly, figures from both subspecies were flashing past Joshua's view, like fragments of nightmare. Joshua got out of there. He ran head down for the ladder, which came dangling from the descending ship. He had to knock one fighter out of the way. He couldn't tell if it was a good guy or a bad guy. Only when he got to the ladder, and, with the security of an alloy rung in his hand, was already rising in the air and out of the battle, did he look back down. The elves favored swords, while the kobolds tended to fight barehanded, which showed rather more intelligence in Joshua's view, because if you were grappling with your opponent, he couldn't step without taking you with him. Besides, the kobolds seemed to have elevated unarmed combat to the point where weapons would merely get in the way. He saw one kobold vanish momentarily as a blade nearly beheaded him, then reappear, grab the sword arm, and with balletic grace, send a kick into the elf's chest that must have killed immediately. As usual with a humanoid fight, it wasn't a battle so much as a series of private duels. If a fighter was victorious, he sought out another opponent, but would be quite oblivious to the fact that a colleague was being backed into a corner by overwhelming odds. And then Joshua saw Finn McCool downed by a wooden sword thrust through his arm. Maybe he tried to step, but he was stunned, confused. His elf opponent dodged a disemboweling swipe from McCool's horny toes and withdrew the sword for a second thrust. Again this elf paused before the moment of the kill. His back was to Joshua. And Joshua had a chance to intervene. Damn it! Joshua let go of the ladder, had his chance of safety, dropped heavily to the ground, picked up a fallen branch, and ran across. It wasn't that Finn McCool had endeared himself to Joshua, but if Joshua had to choose, he'd take the side of someone who hadn't actually tried to kill him, had indeed come back to fight on his side. Still running, he hit the elf across the neck as hard as he could. Joshua had anticipated a satisfying thunk of timber on flesh. Instead, there was a soft necrotic splat, as the rotten branch disintegrated in an explosion of fungus spores and angry beetles. The elf, totally unharmed, turned slowly, its face puckered in astonishment. Finn McCool's good hand flashed out once, twice, and where it hit, there was a sharp crack of bone. The elf folded up on itself and stepped away before it died. Blood was dripping from McCool's arm, but he wasn't paying it any attention. McCool stood up, face to face with Joshua, and Joshua realized that something had gone very wrong.
Pathless one, I kill you many!
The war around them was ceasing. Elves and kobolds alike had paused in mid-slaughter to watch them. Now look! Finn McCool flung back his head and screamed. The flying kick he launched could have killed Joshua in a second, but Joshua had already set off running, heading for that ladder again. He threw himself into the air and grabbed a rung, and to his credit, Bill raised the ship immediately. Joshua looked down from a few yards up to see Finn McCool sprawled, cursing under a tree, his injured arm leaking blood. Then Joshua was rising up through the sparse canopy and into the sunlight, and the montane forest, the messy, sprawling battleground, receded from view. He climbed up the rest of the ladder, through the hatch and into the sanity of the gondola, stood up and cracked his head on the ceiling. He started pulling up the ladder in great tangled armfuls. "That is you, isn't it, Joshua?" Bill asked anxiously. I've been out of touch and to use the radio to bust that elf's jaw.
Just go. Go.
Only when the ladder was up did he let himself sag down onto a couch, fighting for breath. There was no sound up here but the squeaks and groans from the gas bag as it warmed up in the morning's heat. Below him, the shillelagh's shadow drifted peacefully across the forest roof, as if all sorts of hell weren't going on down there in the gloom. He kept seeing Finn McCool's face, a contorted no mask of fury and hatred.
I saved his life. McCool, somehow that made me a deadly enemy. Where's the logic in that?
It's kobold logic, Joshua.
Like human honor, but in a distorting mirror. You shamed him by saving him when he was supposed to be saving you. You want to go down and have a bit of an old chat about it?
Just get us out of here.
The forest below blinked away. Chapter 46. Nelson's first stop in Wyoming, where he had driven in his rental Winnebago on the trail of the Lobsang project, was at Du Bois, cowboy country. Alas, there was a shortage of cowboys nowadays, Wyoming folk having been particularly quick to head for the new stepwise worlds, where land was free and government interference infrequent. It was almost reassuring for Nelson to read on a truck bumper sticker, "In this neighborhood, we don't just watch." He found a longhorn and ordered a beer and a burger. The TV in an upper corner, largely ignored, was showing images of continuing geological problems in Yellowstone, in another part of the state. Swarms of minor earthquakes, an evacuation of some small community, landslips, roads cut. Dead fish in Yellowstone Lake, bubbles rising languidly in some pool of hot mud. But many of these incidents, Nelson slowly gathered, were in fact occurring in stepwise versions of Yellowstone, in the worlds next door. The geologists, scattered over a band of worlds with instruments stripped from long-standing stations on the datum, claimed to be learning a huge amount from comparative studies of the differing behaviors of the stepwise calderas. The newsreaders, vacant and pretty, mimed exaggerated relief that the still overcrowded datum itself didn't seem to be seriously affected, and cracked silly jokes. Nelson looked away, retreating into his own thoughts. It had taken him a month to get here from Chicago, a slow, rambling journey, and a very pleasurable one. He had needed the time to shed his past, the very intense experience of his years as a priest in St. John on the Water. He had been like a deep-sea diver, decompressing, he imagined. In the meantime, the world's mysteries could wait. To his mild irritation, just outside Nelson's window was an animated billboard, fixed to an iron rail fence. It cycled through various distracting messages, which he did his best to ignore. Distractions everywhere. That was the modern world on the datum, anyhow. Then one message caught his eye. "Can you see the humor of this iron railing?" He nearly dropped his burger, which would have been a wicked waste.
"A G.K. Chesterton quote? Here? Good afternoon to you, Lobsang. So, I'm on the right track."
The Winnebago wasn't the fastest machine on the road, but once out of Du Bois, Nelson floored it. He said aloud to anybody listening,
"Strictly speaking, I am doing an amazingly dumb thing. I might be dealing with a madman. Well, I've met one or two of those. But very few of them quoted me the works of one of the best writers Britain ever produced."
Gazing down the empty road, Nelson wondered how long it was since anyone other than a scholar had read the works of G.K. Chesterton. He'd not even read much himself, since he devoured the best of them in his teens, after a chance discovery in a public library in Joburg. Devil's Tower was visible on the horizon ahead when a motorcycle cop pulled him over. The cop wore a dark visor, carried a massive gun in a holster at his hip, and, as he sauntered over, he had an all-round air of menacing dominance.
"Mr. Nelson Azikiwe?"
He took a lot of care with the name.
"I've been expecting you. Show some ID, please."
Nelson drew breath.
"No, sir. Show me your ID. Here we are, two strangers on an empty road, both uncertain of the other's identity and allegiance. A quintessentially Chestertonian moment, don't you think?
The cop's eyes were invisible behind the visor, but he grinned and said,
In the breaking of bridges?
More Chesterton. Automatically, the words coming straight up from the obsessive reading of his adolescence, Nelson said,
Is the end of the world.
Good enough, friend. No further credentials necessary. Unfortunately, a genuine patrol officer is on the horizon, so excuse me for running. You'll find coordinates in your sat-nav.
30 seconds later, his motorbike was lost on the horizon. Of course, the kosher cop, when he arrived, was inquisitive. Nelson went into innocent and mildly disorientated tourist mode, and managed to stall him until three Winnebagos, all with California plates, zoomed past, doing somewhere over 80. Low-hanging fruit that couldn't be ignored by any Wyoming cop. Nelson drove on.
It was the middle of the following day when he drove the Winnebago into the forecourt of an electronics factory and faced locked, unmanned gates, marked with the logo of the Trans-Earth Institute. A small speaker on a pole by his driver's side door demanded, Identify yourself, please. Nelson thought it over. He leaned out and said,
I am Thursday.
Of course you are. Come right inside.
The gate swung open silently. Nelson took a moment to run an online search on that name, Trans-Earth. Then he drove through the gate.
Chapter 47. He found a door, which revealed a short corridor, which led to an elevator.
Please walk forward, said the voice.
Lobsang's voice?
Take the lift. It will operate automatically.
Of course, it could be some kind of trap, but had the voice purposefully called the elevator a lift, British style, to put him at his ease? If so, cute but strange. He walked ahead willingly. The elevator sealed up around him and descended. Even now that disembodied voice spoke to him.
This facility used to belong to the US government. Since being bought by Trans-Earth, somehow it slipped off the map. Governments can be so clumsy.
The elevator door opened to reveal a kind of study, perhaps a rather English design, complete with fireplace and dancing flames, obviously artificial, but crackling fairly realistically. He might also have been back in one of the grander of his parishioners' houses in St. John-on-the-Water. A chair shifted, set beside a low table. A man of indeterminate age stood to meet him, wearing a monk's orange robe, head shaven, smiling, and holding a pipe. Somehow, like the fire, he had an air of artificiality.
Welcome, Nelson Azikiwe.
Nelson stepped forward.
You are Lobsang?
Guilty as charged.
The man waved the pipe vaguely towards another chair.
Please, sit.
They sat, Nelson taking an upright chair opposite Lobsang.
First things first, Lobsang said. We are safe and discreet in this place, which is one of several such support facilities I own across the world, indeed the worlds. Nelson, you are free to walk out of here any time you wish, but I would prefer it if you never spoke about this meeting. Well, I believe a fellow Chestertonian will be discreet. Grant me the liberty of confirming your favorite novel, The Napoleon of Notting Hill, was it not?
The source of the railings quote.
Exactly. Personally, my pick is The Man Who Was Thursday. Still an excellent read, and the precursor of many spy romances over the years. A curious man, Chesterton. Embraced Catholicism like a security blanket, don't you think?
I found him as a kid. When I was digging around in a Joburg library, a stash of ancient books, a relic of the days of the British presence. Probably not been read since apartheid.
Nelson ran out of steam.
He supposed the idea of a Bongali like him, sitting in a dusty library, absorbing the adventures of Father Brown, had been surreal enough. But this situation took the biscuit, as his parishioners might have said. What to ask? Where to begin? He essayed, "Are you part of the Lobsang Project?"
"My dear sir, I am the whole of the project."
Nelson reflected on various searches he'd run.
"You know, I recall gossip about a supercomputer that endeavored to get its owners to accept that it was human, a soul having been reincarnated into the machine at the moment it was booted, something like that. The Nerdosphere consensus was that it was a red herring."
Nelson hesitated.
"It was, wasn't it?"
Lobsang dismissed the question.
"By the way, would you like a drink? I understand you're a beer man."
He stood and crossed to a walnut drinks cabinet. Nelson accepted the drink, half a glass of a heavy, flavoursome brew, and persisted with his questions.
"And are you somehow connected to the Mark Twain expedition?"
"You have me there. That was the second time I found myself close to the glare of public scrutiny, after the circumstances of my miraculous birth, and it was rather harder to escape. I'm afraid poor Joshua Valiente ended up taking more of the resulting attention than he wanted, or deserved, actually, while I receded to the comfort of the shadows."
"And isn't Transearth some kind of subsidiary of the Black Corporation?"
Lobsang smiled.
"Yes, Transearth is partly owned by Black."
"Tell me why I'm here."
"Actually, you came to me, remember? You're here because you solved the puzzle, followed the clues."
"The link between you and the Mark Twain?"
"Quite. But of course you have your own underlying personal connection to Black since your scholarship days. You won't be surprised to find that the Black Corporation has been watching you for some time. You're one of Douglas Black's longer-term investments, in fact."
Lobsang leaned over his table, tapped its surface so that a screen flipped up, and Nelson watched disturbingly familiar images of himself, his family, his life slide past one by one, beginning with his own smiling face as a two-year-old.
"Born in a Johannesburg township, of course. You first came to our attention when your mother put you forward for Black's Searching for the Future program. Scholarships and various other contracts followed, though you were never directly employed by Black. Then came your rise to modest prominence as a paleontologist of the Long Earth, exploring the stepwise past, yes? It was something of a surprise when you took your own sideways step into the Church of England, but Douglas Black believes in allowing those he values to find their own way. He trusts them, you see. And now here you are, well spoken of by Douglas's good friend the Archbishop of Canterbury, yet seeking new directions." He smiled. "Did I miss anything significant?"
Nelson felt needled at the idea he was being manipulated.
"And what are you, sir? Are you anything more than another long-term investment of a rich and powerful man?"
Lobsang was oddly hesitant. Nelson was reminded, surprisingly, of some of his more theologically doubting parishioners.
"In a way? In fact, literally, yes. Technologically speaking, I am a product of Black technologies, beginning with a gel that supports my consciousness. Legally speaking, I am a business partner, a co-owner of a Black corporation subsidiary. Yet beyond that, Douglas gives me great, well, untrammeled freedom. What am I? I believe that I am a reincarnated Tibetan motorbike repairman. I have clear, if somewhat erratic, memories of my former life. Some call me a deranged, if highly intelligent, supercomputer. But I know I have a soul. It's the bit talking to you, correct? And I have dreams. Do you believe that?"
"That's all rather muddled. Are you in need of counseling?"
Lobsang smiled ruefully.
"Probably. But more specifically, I need companions in my quest."
"What quest?"
"Simply put, I am researching the Long Earth phenomenon and all its implications for mankind, and I have come to understand I cannot do it by myself. I need different perspectives, such as yours, Reverend Azikiwe. Your unusual mix of the rational with the mystic. You can't disguise that you too have always searched for truth. One only has to glance at your online activities to perceive that.
Nelson grunted. I suppose there's no point in discussing my right to privacy.
I have a mission for you. A quest. A journey across the long earth. And indeed, across this one. We will be travelling to New Zealand on Earth West number... Well, the numbers scarcely matter, do they?
New Zealand? And what will we be travelling to see?
You saw the records of the Mark Twain expedition, I believe. Those that were made public, at least.
Yes.
Did you come across references to the entity known as First Person Singular?
Nelson stayed silent, but his curiosity was like a fish hook in his flesh.
Lobsang shifted in his chair. What do you say?
It's all a bit sudden, isn't it? I need to think about it.
The Twain will be here tomorrow.
Fine.
He stood.
I'll sleep in my vehicle overnight. That will give me time to consider.
Lobsang stood too, smiling. Take all the time you need. That night, there was a thunderstorm, a real humdinger coming in from the west, and rain that made the Winnebago sound as if it were a target on a firing range. Nelson lay in his bed, listening to the barrage, and considering the world in general, and his current situation in particular, including a sidebar on the nature of souls. It was strange how many people he'd met who had no use for Orthodox Christianity, yet nevertheless unthinkingly believed that they had a soul. It was stranger still to think that perhaps you could create a soul, or at least create a body that could store a soul. Suddenly he was eager to begin this journey with Lobsang, if only to get to know Lobsang himself. And yet there was residual suspicion. He remembered what Lobsang had said somewhat enigmatically. Actually, you came to me, remember? You're here because you solved the puzzle, followed the clues.
True. But who had planted those clues in the first place?
The next morning, he called to arrange pick-up for the rental Winnebago. At noon, the promised Twain dropped soundlessly out of the sky. Nelson had travelled on Twains many times before, but this one seemed rather Spartan, a 200-foot envelope over a compact streamlined gondola. The Twain lowered a safety harness and pulled him up into the air. He was deposited in an area near the stern. Once out of the harness, he made his way through a cramped interior to a lounge-cum-galley that evidently doubled as an observation deck. He felt, rather than heard, motors start up. And suddenly, through big-picture windows, he saw he was in storm clouds with rain battering the windows, and then hot sunshine that caused the hull to steam. Stepping already, then. He had taken anti-nausea pills, recommended by Lobsang, and despite his usual aversion to stepping, felt little discomfort. A short staircase led him to a door to a wheelhouse, above the lounge, a door which appeared to be locked. As he tried the door handle, a screen on the wall lit up, showing a smiling, shaven-headed visage. Glad to have you aboard, Nelson.
Glad to be here, Lobsang.
I am, as you may guess, the pilot of this craft.
Which, Lobsang, am I talking to?
I invite you to understand that Lobsang is not simply a single presence. To call me ubiquitous doesn't do the trick. Remember the movie Spartacus? Well, all of me are Spartacus. It does require regular downtime to sink us all, me all. You're alone on the ship, but should you require a physical presence, for instance for medical reasons, I can activate an ambulant unit. We will make for New Zealand, stepping more or less continuously to find the most auspicious winds world by world. Believe it or not, on a Twain, I like to do it the gentle way.
I'll try to relax and enjoy the ride, then.
Do that. Relaxing was one thing Joshua Valiente never managed.
Valiente certainly didn't look very relaxed on the clip I found of him returning to Madison, a clip that led me to this point, in fact, to you. A clip you probably sent me yourself, right?
He'd committed himself to this peculiar quest, but his resentment of the idea that he had been controlled, drawn into this situation, started to morph to anger.
How far back does your influence extend? I don't suppose you had anything to do with establishing a chat group called the Quizmasters. Were you, in fact, behind the entire trail of breadcrumbs that led me to you?
Lobsang smiled. From now on, no more tricks.
I hope not. Nobody likes being manipulated, Lobsang.
I don't think of it as manipulation. I think of it as the setting out of an opportunity. It's up to you whether you take that opportunity or not.
Yesterday you called me an investment.
That's Douglas Black's language, not mine. And remember, Nelson, as I pointed out, you came to me in the end. Look, whether we end up working together or not, welcome aboard and enjoy the ride. If nothing else, think of it as a vacation, if you like.
Or an audition.
If you will.
Nelson smiled back.
But Lobsang, who is auditioning whom?
Chapter 48. The Beagle and the Kobold approached, walking out of the dusty distance. In their rough camp, Jansen and Sally stood wary. As the creatures drew near, Jansen was very aware of an emptiness at her belt where her cop-issue stepper box ought to be. The Beagle, the dog man, had confiscated it on the day they'd arrived, and so she, at least, without Sally's aid, had been stuck here ever since on this peculiar world with its strange inhabitants. It was the first time they'd been visited in the week or so that they'd been here since they'd been met in the Rectangle's world and brought to this earth a couple of dozen steps further west, to a world full of trolls, as Sally said she could feel, hear, as soon as they arrived. The Beagles were waiting, they were told, for the return of some kind of ruler from someplace else. It would be this ruler who would deal with the humans. Jansen supposed it gave them time to get their bearings, for her to recover somewhat from the journey so far. Even that first jaunt from Rectangles to here had been a grotesque experience, because the Beagle who had met them couldn't step. It had had to be carried on the back of the squat, ugly humanoid Sally had called a kobold. It had all been a rush of strangeness for them both. Even Sally, Jansen had learned, the great explorer of the Long Earth, had known nothing of this place before being brought here, lured by the gossip of the kobolds. To Sally, this world had been just another joker, just another desert world in a band of such worlds which, apparently, had lost much of their water through calamity during the turbulent epoch of planetary formation. On such a world, geological activity was going to be reduced, life restricted. That was the theory. In fact, as Jansen was learning, on many jokers, there were habitable refuges. On this world, there was an island of green, of moisture. From what the kobold had said, Sally had guessed it could be the size of Europe. Unnoticed by dismissive previous explorers, including Joshua and Sally, who had come rushing through this world too hastily. Unnoticed by the team of researchers who had followed that first expedition to Rectangles. They had been datum-raised workers, with datum-trained expectations, who thought in terms of one world thick, and never looked stepwise. Well, here they were, in a world that hosted these dogs, these strange sapients, and evidently the trolls in great concentrations. For a long interval there was silence. The dog beasts seemed to like to stare, to study, to think before speaking. The grammar of their interactions was not like the human. Jansen and Sally just stood there, waiting. The kobold had a wounded arm, Jansen noticed now, roughly bandaged with a soiled rag. He cackled, evidently enjoying the moment. The trolls who travelled with them didn't seem bothered in the slightest. Mary sat on a knoll, humming a tune that was naggingly familiar to Jansen, while Ham happily raked the ground with his strong fingers, periodically popping grubs into his mouth. as if, Jansen thought, being approached by a bipedal dog wearing a ray gun happened every day. The beagle stood before the woman, eyes unblinking, that mobile wet nose quivering as, evidently, he smelled them. He must have been nearly 7 feet tall, and he towered over both Jansen and Sally. But that and the ray gun were the only reasons he was so intimidating, Jansen realized.